Abre la ventana que vive la mañana, al cuarto y la cocina. Aire, aire,
lele, pom pom.
Aire, pasa.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the program. Before our interview with Michael Smith, we discussed what kind of music we would play at the beginning of the program, and he chose flamenco music. Mike, could you please tell me and the listeners why flamenco music? Why is it important to you?
I love this music, John. Back in the 1980s, my wife and I, we enjoyed listening to flamenco. And we took many classes in London to learn how to dance in this particularly Spanish style. I also played flamenco on my guitar because I played the guitar since I was a child. But then I suffered a personal disaster when I was arrested in August of 1992 for allegedly being a KGB spy.
Really?
The following year, I was put on trial under Britain's Official Secrets Act. I was convicted and sentenced to 20 years imprisonment. As a result, I was locked up for more than 10 years in a prison cell.
That sounds absolutely horrible, Mike.
And in order to keep my sanity, I used to listen to flamenco music.
Spying is a serious matter. Can you tell me and our listeners what the allegations against you were?
The prosecution at my trial claimed that in the mid-1970s, I had been recruited as a KGB agent by a man named Viktor Oshenko, who had worked as a diplomat in London. It was also argued that Russian intelligence had put me on ice until 1990 as a sort of sleeper awaiting reactivation.
Wow.
Apparently, without warning, Oshenko defected to Britain in July of 1992, a week before my arrest, and it was claimed that he had named me as a spy. Oshenko has never confirmed this allegation. After my arrest, I was interviewed by the police, and I was asked if I was aware of the archive leaks that had taken place in Russia. Now, that was in 1992, and I could not possibly have known what this question referred to. Years later, in 1999, it emerged that another KGB officer, Vasily Mitrokhin, had mentioned my name some months before Oshenko defected.
I'm sure that a lot of our listeners may not know who Vasily Mitrokhin was, so perhaps you could tell us who was Vasily Mitrokhin, or who is Vasily Mitrokhin?
Mitrokhin was a senior archivist at KGB headquarters until he retired in 1984. He arrived at the British Embassy in Riga in March of 1992, offering information he had copied from files while he worked in the KGB archives. This was clearly of interest to Britain's MI6. Richard Tomlinson, then an MI6 officer, was one of the people given the job of recovering Mitrokhin's notes when it was decided to help Mitrokhin leave Russia and move into Britain.
I'd never heard that before.
It was quickly realized that Mitrokhin's papers were just handwritten notes, no original papers. So his archive was effectively worthless in a British court of law. MI5 needed to show that at least one spy had been discovered as a result of Mitrokhin's defection, and it appears that I had been chosen as the ideal candidate, because in the late 1970s, I had worked on Britain's freefall nuclear bomb.
So you believe that you had been chosen as an ideal candidate. That's very interesting. And maybe we'll get back to that later. I think we'd all be interested to know who would have chosen you. So were Oshenko and Mitrokhin, were they witnesses at your trial?
No. There was no official evidence used at my trial from either of them. The jury had expected to hear evidence from Oshenko, and even asked two questions about it near the end of the trial.
Wow, yeah, that's interesting.
But Oshenko gave no evidence at all, nor has he ever said anything publicly about my case.
So, could you tell us who were the main witnesses against you then?
Well, Stella Rimington, she was one main witness. She was the Director General of MI5, and she came dressed in a disguise so she couldn't be recognised. She gave a lot of information that could have been found in spy fiction books, and in fact she now writes them. Her most damaging claim was that Russian intelligence used Portugal as a location to train their agents.
I didn't know that.
Now, I had been on holiday with a friend in 1977, and we had spent 3 days in Oporto. This was a purely innocent visit, but Rimington claimed that she believed I had been there to meet a KGB officer, although there was no evidence to prove that that was what had happened.
And Stella Rimington,
she's a good storyteller. In fact, she stated on oath that MI5 had no evidence I'd ever met any KGB officers. The second main prosecution witness was Oleg Gordievsky, another KGB defector. He was used to back up Rimington's evidence, and he said that he recognised Russian techniques in the notes that I had made. And again, he highlighted my visit to Oporto. Now, Gordievsky is known to exaggerate, and he did everything he could to identify examples of what he called typical KGB tradecraft.
So you're saying that Rimington, under oath, said that there was no evidence that you had actually worked for the KGB, and Gordievsky only gave biased evidence about supposed KGB techniques. Sounds quite sinister. You've mentioned on your blog, Mr. Smith, that you were a victim of MI5 entrapment. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Yes. This played a big part in my conviction. In the early 1990s, I was offered money by a man pretending to be seeking industrial information. I didn't know at that time that he was really working for MI5, but he offered me money for what I thought was worthless information, and I fell for his bait.
Mm-hmm.
He gave me £50 notes in sequential, serialised batches straight from the bank. I thought this money must be traceable, but the prosecution gave no evidence about its source, and they claimed it must have come from Russian intelligence. Later, an MI5 officer phoned me at home in August of 1992 and encouraged me to go to a nearby telephone kiosk. He called himself George and mentioned another man named Victor. The prosecution in court claimed that Victor could only refer to Victor Ashenko.
And weren't you suspicious that you had fallen into a trap, possibly set up by MI5?
Well, it's easy to be wise in hindsight, isn't it? Throughout the 1980s, I had a feeling that I was being watched. I received odd phone calls and saw strangers acting suspiciously near my home. But at that time, I never thought I was being targeted by the British Secret Service. It was admitted later that MI5 had put me under surveillance between 1977 and 1992.
And why do you think you were targeted by MI5? What do you think their real reasons were?
My only crime appears to be that, as a young man, I had become interested in left-wing politics. I had been a member of the Communist Party in the early 1970s. I later became disillusioned with politics and resigned, and I found a job that brought me into contact with defence projects at the Ministry of Defence contractors.
Well, I'm sure you're not alone in having become disillusioned with politics. How did you come to be mentioned in the Matrokhin archive?
On a couple of occasions, I have been introduced to Russians at social functions. These Russians were invited by one of the local trade union organisers who had some contacts with the Soviet embassy in London, and occasionally invited trade union representatives to events in the area where I was living. These diplomats, I understand, would have made reports or given the names of the people they met, if nothing more than to justify their expenses for these visits. It is easy to imagine how my name was recorded somewhere, or could have found its way into KGB files. I visited the Soviet Union in 1976 on a holiday, and I would have required a visa at that time.
So what you're saying is that Mitrokhin probably got your name from some diplomat's expense book? Very interesting. Now, I'd like to ask you a bit of a more serious question. To get such a long sentence, I mean, 20 years is an incredibly long time, you must have been found with some very sensitive documents. Is that correct?
I had the lowest level of security clearance, with no access to secret documents. My trial was based on a lot of old documents I had cleared from my desk on the day that I left my job. And this material was nearly all 5 to 10 years old. I thought it had no value whatsoever. During the trial, a senior Ministry of Defence scientist gave evidence that one of the documents, already over 10 years old at the time of my arrest, had been used on Britain's Alarm missile during the 1991 Gulf War.
Mm-hmm.
The prosecution claimed it would have enabled the missile to be jammed and could have put British lives at risk. Because this evidence was disclosed at the last minute, my lawyers had no chance to contradict it, and we could find no expert to help me in my later appeal in 1995.
So it sounds to me like your trial was completely unfair and that you may have been singled out for whatever reasons they may have had. Is that what you have been trying to say?
Yes. My trial was clearly unfair. The prosecution case throughout was biased against the truth. Most of the trial was held in secret, so that the public could not hear the proceedings. When I complained about this false evidence, I was simply ignored for years by the government authorities. Even as late as 2006, my Member of Parliament was denied answers to his question whether that key document had been used on the Alarm missile. It was not until 2007 that I finally learned that this document became obsolete in 1984. So it could not have been used on any Alarm missiles.
Mm-hmm.
That is typical of the false evidence used to convict me, which indicates why the prosecution hid these details for the past 17 years. In 1998, the ex-MI6 officer, Richard Tomlinson, told my lawyers that he had seen an internal MI5 report which concluded that my case didn't involve any damaging secrets. Mr. Tomlinson's view was that MI5 had exaggerated the alleged damage in my case in order to secure a long sentence and to cultivate the mystique of the importance of their work.
Yeah, I think they need to cultivate the mystique so as to justify their huge budgets. Anyway, you also seem very critical of Stella Rimington and Oleg Gordievsky. Can you tell us a little bit about that, please?
Well, both Rimington's and Gordievsky's evidence was contradicted by a defense expert, an ex-CIA station chief, who said there was nothing exclusively KGB about the facts in my case.
Really?
He backed his arguments with a list of 14 points and criticized Rimington's and Gordievsky's opinions that the evidence pointed to KGB espionage. In fact, this CIA expert said that the KGB were a very professional organization, and they could not have been responsible for the amateur entrapment in my case.
Hmm.
Bill Colby, the former director of the CIA, also told my lawyers that the evidence in my case did not prove KGB involvement. There was even a suggestion that MI5 had used a false flag entrapment to imitate the behavior of a foreign intelligence agency.
I'm aware that Stella Rimington, who you've mentioned several times already, has written a book, and you were not mentioned in that book. Can you tell us anything about that, please?
Yes, and it is interesting that she has not referred to my case at all. Although I was the only major spy case during her time as head of MI5.
Yeah, that's interesting.
She must be embarrassed by my case now, and it has written me out of history, effectively. It was interesting that in 1999, when the Mitrokhin archive was published, that the so-called training mission to Portugal appeared to refer to a visit to Lisbon in 1979, and not to a port in 1977.
I'm sure our listeners are wondering, at least some of them must be, and I myself was curious to know, have you ever met Oleg Gordievsky, Mike?
No, I've never met him. But considering Gordievsky was the KGB resident in London in the early 1980s, and he said he had exposed all the KGB's agents in Britain, it was surprising when he admitted in court that he had never heard of me. Very surprising when it was the prosecution claim that I had been a major KGB spy between the mid-1970s to the early 1990s.
Well, that also sounds very suspicious as well. Is entrapment a common method used by MI5?
The Mitrokhin archive must have come as a shock to MI5, because it indicated that the British establishment had been totally penetrated by foreign agents over many decades.
Wow.
I believe that MI5 wanted to salvage its reputation and to demonstrate that it was still capable of catching a few spies. But catching real spies isn't an easy task, and so MI5 used entrapment as a method to more or less manufacture a few spies. My conviction was a morale boost for MI5, a sort of show trial, and they went on to stage more entrapment operations against defence industry workers. For example, Rafael Bravo in 2001 and Ian Parr in 2002. MI5 officers pretended to be Russian agents, arranging to meet these men to exchange money for documents. But it was a trap, and they were arrested. And Bravo got a sentence of 11 years, and Parr, 10 years.
Yeah, those are also some very interesting cases. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about them sometime in the future. Well, thank you very much, Mike, for joining us today and for allowing us to ask you some questions. Le pasa que tenga la puerta abierta, la alegría de mi casa.